First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Low turnout, dark money, allegations of voter suppression. Yes, it's almost election day in Jacksonville. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, what you need to know about tomorrow's special election in Duval. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, the Jaguars lose again, just as their former QB Gardner Minshew helps another team soar. That's ahead, along with a conversation with the relatively new CEO of JEA. We'll talk about the future of energy in Florida. But first this hour, early voting ended Sunday, but more people, a small number, will turn out tomorrow for the city's special election. Four candidates are on the ballot, two Democrats, two Republicans, all vying to fill the seat on city council vacated by the late Tommy Hazzouri. Meanwhile, there are accusations of voter suppression around tomorrow's election. Campaign finance reports also show the hand of dark money in this race. WJCT News' Raymond Troncoso is covering the special, and he's on the line. Raymond, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being with us. Very low turnout already in early voting for this election. What are your thoughts? And will you go out and cast a ballot for this at-large seat on city council tomorrow to replace the late Tommy Hazzouri? You need to get out and vote, folks. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Already getting your tweets. Raymond, how was the turnout overall for early voting, which ended yesterday?
Pretty low. Overall, there were about 44,000 ballots cast. That's out of, you know, nearly 650,000 eligible voters. So it's below 7%. We kind of consider low turnout to be between like 10 and 15%, which is kind of what Mike Hogan has been, the supervisor of elections, has been predicting is that it's going to be between. But yeah, it's below 7%, which is pretty dismal.
Yeah. If we crack 10%, I think they'll consider that a victory, unfortunately. So folks, we've said this over and over. If you're someone who complains about the way local government is run, here's one small chance to have your voice heard. Go out and vote in tomorrow's special election to fill this city council seat. So Raymond, some polling places were closed for this special election. Local pastors and other community leaders complained about that, saying it's voter suppression. So can you spend a little time explaining what's going on with that?
Yeah, so basically in 2020 election, we had 20 early voting sites that were open for a considerable amount of time. For this special election, which, you know, was kind of put together on a little bit of short notice, Supervisor Mike Hogan shortened the number of hours that these sites were open and also closed five of them. So now there were only 15 places that you could vote early as opposed to 20. And where those closures happened tended to be in areas that were lower income, places that had high percentage of usage by Black residents, Hispanic residents. And that's something that obviously a lot of people in the community took issue with.
Yeah. And so what was the response from Supervisor of Elections Hogan? Is his view that there just isn't enough turnout to maintain those sites?
Yeah. So basically he says, you know, we don't collect financial data. We don't collect racial data on who votes where. These decisions were made based on geographic location, and they were made based on the fact that we're not expecting high turnout. So he didn't feel that it was a good use of money and resources basically to have 20 sites open when he didn't feel like a lot of people were going to show up anyway. And that's kind of the rationale that he's put out there to basically defend these decisions.
I see. It's 549-2937. There were changes made to voting earlier this year that took effect statewide as well that will affect this election and all elections going forward. Let's talk about what voters can expect there, Raymond.
Yeah. So earlier this year, Ron DeSantis signed basically what he calls a voting integrity law. Opponents of his would call it a voter suppression law. And basically, it doesn't go as far as, you know, some of the other voting laws that have grabbed national headlines, like in Georgia. But it does make things a little bit stricter. Voter drop boxes, which were something that were big in 2020 because it was an election being held during coronavirus, those basically have to be watched 24/7 if you want to be have them open. They need to be watched by a paid staffer at all times. That really limits when people can drop off their ballot, because basically the point of them is that, all right, if I can't show up during regular hours, maybe after work I can drop off, you know, my mail ballot into this drop box. Now you can't do that. You can only do it when there's someone actually there to watch the box. And that requires a lot more money by election supervisors who've mostly elected to either not have drop boxes, or in the case of Duval County, they're only open during regular hours anyway, when you might as well get in line.
What are your questions about tomorrow's special election? 549-2937. Let's talk about the candidates on the ballot, if we could, for a little bit, Raymond. There are two Democrats and two Republicans on the ballot that voters can choose from to fill the seat vacated by the late former mayor, city council member, school board member, Tommy Hazzouri. He left a large political legacy. The winner of this race, well, there will be a runoff election most likely, but the eventual winner of this race will become the at-large Group 3 council member through June of 2023. If no candidate gets at least 50% plus one tomorrow night, the two candidates with the most votes advance to a second election in February. So that'll be an even lower turnout election. A very small number of people are choosing this next public official. Let's talk about the candidates. Nick Howland, James Jacobs, Tracy Polson, and Howdy Russell. Two Republicans, two Democrats.
Mm-hmm. So I think the conventional wisdom is that it's probably going to come down between the people who have the most institutional support, which would be Howland and Tracy Polson, in terms of, you know, the money, the resources that they've pulled in, the endorsements that they've received. You know, we're going to have to obviously wait until tomorrow to see if that's true. But again, this is going to be someone who's filling the seat for, you know, about 15 months. And then they're going to have to do it all over again in an even bigger race with maybe even more money put behind it.
Yeah. Let's talk about the two front runners, Nick Howland and Tracy Polson. Tracy Polson has run for office before. She's a licensed mental health professional, a small business owner. She sees the top issues facing the city as resiliency and infrastructure, criminal justice reform, and economic development. Nick Howland is the leading Republican in the race. He is the executive director of the Firewatch, a veteran suicide prevention organization. He sees the top three issues facing the city as public safety, jobs, and strategic growth. They tend to take typical positions that hew closely to the party line on a range of issues. And as we talk about this, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Let's go to a few tweets. In the meantime, we are hearing from a lot of you on Twitter this morning. Here is a tweet from one listener. I would like to hear an honest accounting of exactly why they had to close early voting sites, which create a vicious cycle with low turnout. Also, how did the new vote-by-mail dropbox state laws increase staff required and drive up cost? She says, I poll watched this weekend at an early voting site. It was well-run and professional. However, they had to dedicate two staff at all times to guard the vote-by-mail dropbox, which was in a small room full of people. It seemed a waste of personnel driven by the new state voting law and the state unfunded mandate, she says, Raymond.
Yeah, and that's the reason why a lot of places have either elected to limit the time that those drop boxes are open, which almost kind of defeats the point of them, or have elected to not have drop boxes at all, because it you know, there's no funding for it in the bill. That comes out of the city budgets, right? The local municipal budgets for the election supervisor, who need to pay people to basically just sit there and watch them.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about tomorrow's special election in Duval County. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Give us a call, 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Paula. Supervisor of Elections Hogan says they don't collect demographic data. He's not saying they can't. This is a decision made to make low-income voters and people of color invisible and less likely to vote. Raymond, is there evidence to support that or not?
Well, if not targeted, it does appear that that has been the result in some locations. For example, one of the locations closed was the University Park Branch Library. Now, when you look at the median income for that area, it's lower than the Jacksonville median income to average. And the percentage of black residents that used that site in 2020 was, 44% was the turnout of early voters who were black residents at that location. Since that's been closed, the nearest early voting site is over 6 miles away. And so those people who lived in that area don't really have recourse unless, they're willing to drive 6 miles or take multiple bus routes to one of these other early voting sites.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to get people to turn out to vote in the 4-year presidential cycle. Now these candidates are trying to get people out to vote in this very obscure time when they're not used to going out and voting. It's a big lift, and it's why we're trying to talk about it on the show, since we do focus on local government. Give us a call, folks. It's 549-2937. Are you a super voter? Are you a regular voter? Are you an infrequent voter? What are your thoughts about voting in these special elections? Here's a message from a listener. He says, please look at the candidates' financial reports. For example, on Nick Howland's financials, it seems legal, but it violates at least the spirit of campaign finance laws. He received $10,000 from 10 different PACs that all share the same address. And if I looked, I would bet they all had the same officers. Gary Chartrand used to do things like that, donating multiple times to the same candidate under many different entities. Okay. That's true, by the way. That goes on frequently in Florida. So you know what? You can go to DuvalElections.com and look up all of the candidates' financial reports, see who donated to the candidates. I took this listener up on his request. When you go to Nick Howland's financial report, there are 10 different donations in the amount of $1,000 each from theoretically different entities, but they all come from the same address. The Florida Accountability Fund, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida, $1,000. Accountability in Government, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Committee for Responsible Representation, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Americans for Liberty and Prosperity, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. And as you go down the list, there are more from this same address. Sunshine State First, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Florida Taxpayers Defense, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Liberty Leadership Fund, 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Very conservative. 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Good Government for Florida. Sunshine State Rising. Realtors Political Advocacy. All from 115 East Park Avenue, Suite 1, Tallahassee, Florida. Now, this is not to single out this particular candidate. This happens a lot in this state where dark money, Raymond, barely legal, skirts campaign finance laws to elect the candidate of their choice, where one wealthy individual or maybe a small group of wealthy individuals puts the money in lots of different buckets, theoretically under different PACs, to put their thumb on the scale to elect the candidate they want. Now, that's not to say it's illegal, but it certainly violates the spirit, if not the letter, of the law. Raymond.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what our elected officials have decided is permissible in elections. And if people want to win, unfortunately, in elections, they need money. And like you said, maybe it's putting the thumb on the scale, but pretty much everyone needs resources to run a campaign. And some people may do it openly with their donations, where people donate, the maximum legal amount. And some people have to turn to PACs where, you can't really tell where that money comes from. And, like you said, it's not illegal, As to whether it's moral, of course, that's another question. But if people want to win, these are the kind of tactics that they pursue in Florida and other states.
549-2937, Yvonne in Jacksonville. Yvonne, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for having this service available to us so that we can have a say-so. I guess I'd call myself a super voter. I always vote in the elections for the last at least 15 years. And last year, my polling place was changed. I'm in the 32216 zip code.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's changed again to about halfway down Beach Boulevard. Additionally, I've been asked to come in and prove my signature. My signature hasn't changed either.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand why all of a sudden there are things in the way beyond just my personal circumstance this year, caretaking, and I'm still going to arrange to vote, but I'd be curious to know if there's any way to see how many people are being asked to prove their signatures compared to other elections. Well, I realize it might be considered a low turnout election.
Yeah, thanks. Yvonne, you know, critics of that call it a form of voter suppression. Thank you for that, the call, and I'm sorry you have to go through that extra hurdle. Raymond Troncoso.
Yes, so this is the first election that we've seen since that voting rights law passed that's going to have those requirements where you have to prove your signature. You know, that's something that's new. We're not really sure how strict it's going to be. Maybe it might differ according to each supervisor, so we might see some counties where more ballots get tossed out than others. We can kind of go by, I guess, percentage of tossed out mail ballots in this special election, and that might bode either well or bode awful for, you know, the really big one in next year in 2022 when we have the midterms.
And 2024, sure. We'll have to leave it there. We're running up against a break. But go to DuvalElections.com, find your polling place, get out and vote tomorrow. Read more at WJCT.org. Raymond Troncoso, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And a quick note, we want to say goodbye to the longtime maitre d' of the Casa Marina Hotel and Restaurant in Jacks Beach. Sterling Joyce passed away last week at the age of 71. He will be well remembered. Up next, the future of energy in Florida, a conversation with JEA's CEO, Jay Stowe. That's after this.
My name's Casey Morell, and I'm a producer and director for NPR's afternoon news magazine, All Things Considered. The job of a show director is directing our engineer and our hosts and guiding them through what's coming up in that broadcast. It's kind of like being the conductor on a very fast-moving train. The show has a specific clock, and if you imagine the show as a train, it has to get to specific stations at exactly the same time every single day. It's fun. It's a fun job. I'm a member of three different NPR stations. I've lived in a bunch of different places, and one thing that has helped me feel like each of those places was home was my local NPR station. When you donate to this station, you are directly supporting shows that you love and all the work behind the scenes that keeps them up and running. Here is how to give.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org/radio.
Welcome back. A grand jury investigation is still ongoing into the failed attempt to privatize this city's utility. Meanwhile, JEA carries on with new leadership in place after the controversy that had engulfed the utility in previous years. For more about the future of energy in Florida, I spoke with Jay Stowe, Chief Executive Officer at JEA. Hi, Jay. Good to talk to you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate it.
You know, as we've all learned here in Jacksonville over the last several years, people care a lot about JEA in this community. They have a personal connection to it, and there has been a lot of controversy around this utility, but you've been managing hopefully calmer seas for JEA over the last year. Can you first bring us up to date on what it's been like for you and your leadership team during the pandemic, as you transition to a hybrid work environment like so many other companies have done? What's it been like steering through these times for you?
So, first of all, it had been and was kind of a crazy period of time for JEA, and I am impressed by the level of interest that this community has towards the local utility that is publicly owned and not-for-profit, and has the support and the care from the community is really just, it's hard to put into words, really. I think we've come through that period of time in large part because of the 2,000 employees who have been every day trying to do the right thing and to do the best thing and to keep things stable. The leadership team was transitioning for a large part of this year. And that's been one of my focuses, is to build this team that is reflecting the diversity that we see in Northeast Florida and Jacksonville. And I think our leadership team's been in place for 2 or 2.5 months now, fully in place. And we are ready to take off, doing what's best for our customers, delivering business excellence, and continuing to build an unbeatable team and to jump off of the place where the 2,000 employees have been. They've been doing every day for the last several years.
Sure. So let's look ahead to 2021. There are so many issues to get into. Before we get to emissions and the fossil fuel mix that utilities like JEA work with, I want to first ask you about what's going on the water side, a sustainable water supply for this area, and also how you're trying to phase out septic tanks in city neighborhoods. Bring us up to date on that, if you could.
Phasing out septic tanks, reducing the discharge to the St. John's River, and providing clean, safe drinking water for our community is a focus that we have on lots of different fronts. So I appreciate the starting there. I think it's very important for us to protect the public health through clean, safe drinking water and the treatment of the wastewater in to provide for public safety, which is fire protection for our community. And then we can really jump off and do economic development for the area. We have a partnership with the city of Jacksonville to replace septic tanks. And so far we've got about $82 million worth of projects kind of in the hopper. They're either complete or being completed to try to chip away at a problem that's been around for 50 plus years. And we're making progress on that. Several neighborhoods are under construction right now, and several are under design. So we're focused on getting that done. And then we are continuing to work with the legislation that was passed last year for surface water discharge elimination. Between now and 2032, we will eliminate all the discharge to the St. John's River, and whether we reuse that or go through our water purification project to provide purified water into the aquifer and to replenish the aquifer, we'll make those decisions over the next few years. But it's a very big focus for us.
Sure. Let me ask you as well about your new energy mix policy. What JEA is saying is that you want up to 30% of your power to be carbon neutral by 2030, so within 9 years. Is that an aggressive enough target?
That is a target that was put in place a few years ago. In order to answer the, is that the right target, we have are just starting an integrated resource plan for our electric system. That plan will look out over the next 20 or 30 years and chart our course with regard to our supply and generation. It'll focus on renewables, carbon footprint discussions. We'll really have a big part of that. And then we'll also get input from the community. We're developing a stakeholder group of community from the community to help us look at all the different scenarios that we have to play, would have to come into play for us to make the best decision on what the energy mix should be.
Well, you know, of course, the reason I ask is certainly utilities everywhere are under pressure to decarbonize, but it's easier said than done. It's a difficult transition to make. Can you share with our listeners what some of the biggest challenges are to shifting to solar, wind, biomass, and other sources of energy that are not fossil fuel dependent?
Sure. Well, the biggest single transition that we're making is through our investment in Plant Vogtle, the nuclear plant that is scheduled to come online next year.
Mm-hmm.
The second round, we've had several coal-fired plants that have been decommissioned in the last few years, including one that we are we get a PPA, a power purchase agreement through Plant Shear that ends at the end of this month, and that will reduce our coal. So transitioning from coal to gas is a little bit of a carbon reduction. Transitioning to nuclear is a much larger carbon reduction. And then we have a plan to install about 250 megawatts of solar over the next little while, I would say. And so all of that helps us diversify our electric generation fleet, continues to allow us to be good stewards of the environment, and focuses on carbon reduction.
Let me ask you another question about broadband. I know that there's a group out there, jackspublicinternet.org, that's been lobbying JEA about this. Can you tell me a little bit about municipal broadband and where your leadership is on this?
Sure. We have had fiber in our system for years, and we will continue to use fiber to improve the operations of our own water and electric system. And so increasing fiber into the into Jacksonville, Northeast Florida, to improve our own operations is something we'll be very focused on. And while we're doing that, we're studying whether and what the level of broadband saturation is in the territory, and then we will start to make some decisions on how best to proceed with supporting improved broadband connectivity in Northeast Florida. And whether that's us doing it or someone else doing it, we don't know yet. We have not made a decision that it's something that we should be doing. We want to be sure that we're able to support Northeast Florida the best we can. I've been involved with some broadband deployments in previous jobs, and I've seen other utilities, municipal utilities, implement broadband successfully. And so I think there's lots of different models, and we will study those and make the best decision we can in the next 6 months to a year.
Sure. Now, electric bills are going up for JEA customers starting this month. That's something I know you're hearing about from the public. Can you share with us a little bit more about what went into this and what consumers might expect over the next few years when it comes to their utility bills?
Yeah, it is. We try to control our costs the best we can. There have been outside influences that have driven up cost, most particularly natural gas prices, which are similar to what people see at the at their gas stations at the pump. And the natural gas that we bought had a very steep increase in cost, not unlike lumber a few months ago and a lot of other commodities that people buy today for themselves. And so when prices go up like that, then we have to pass those costs on to our customers. We have implemented a new structure for how we do that with a fuel cost adjustment that will adjust each month. We'll see a couple of months or two or three months of small increases with the fuel cost adjustment. We think it should stabilize after that, and then as it drops back down again, we will also drop our fuel costs, and that will adjust slightly up or down depending on the direction of natural gas and coal prices going forward. And we expect that while it will be a couple of months of higher fuel costs, we think over the course of the year we will drop back down again.
So next year you're expected to move into a new headquarters near the Duval County Courthouse. It's really a symbolic of a turning of the page, I think, for JEA in more ways than one. Of course, you've come in as CEO after scandal in the past, and there is an ongoing grand jury investigation into the failed attempt to privatize JEA. How much of your job do you see as restoring the public's trust in this utility? We have seen how important JEA is to the community and how strongly people feel about it remaining public, not private. So what are your thoughts about that as you move into a new headquarters and you look ahead to a new year?
Well, I think that, first of all, my focus is not to rebuild trust. I think trust from the community and from the employees is something that happens because of the actions that we take. And so we are focused on our values, which are safety, respect, and integrity. Safety being broader than just physical safety, but also emotional safety for our employees and customers. Respect is how we treat each other with courtesy and respect each day. If we treat each other well, then it's easier for everyone else to be treated well, and we'll focus on that. And then integrity is really what I think you're talking about, and we will have the highest regard for integrity and ethical decisions that we make every single day. If we do each one of those things, then trust will follow. And I think that what I've been focused on for the first, most of this first year, besides building what is a, what I think is a fantastic leadership team, is to be able to reach out and be sure that the employees know and can believe the JEA is a great place to work and that we are serving the community well. When we do that, then it plays out in the community as something that is positive, and I think people will begin to trust us. But I don't think they should necessarily trust us just because there's a new person here. I think it's our actions that then turn into that trust. And I hope that our actions are showing that we are trustworthy and that we are serving the community well.
Well, I thank you for your time. He's Jay Stowe, Managing Director and CEO at JEA. Have a great holiday, Jay, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Remember when you started listening to public radio? A whole world opened up with all these different voices, and you were all ears. Hey, I'm Elsa Chang, and on this NPR station, there is always something, someone new to discover. That's possible thanks to listeners who donate. And now that you're in the know, if you've never given, become a new donor now. Here's how.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org/radio.
Well, the Jaguars lost again yesterday, this time to the Rams, but their former quarterback Gardner Minshew had a great day helping the Eagles soar high above the Jets. Josh Torres took in a lot of football and other sports over the weekend. Hey, Josh, good morning.
Hello, Melissa. And yes, this weekend was packed and I was very busy trying to keep up with all of it.
Yeah.
So we're going to start off with the Jags. Another week, another disappointment at this point, honestly. And this is coming from what I've seen on Twitter and fans, what they're saying. Everybody's basically just given up on this season. They really don't, when you look at their schedule, they really don't have a lot left that they're going to be able to do something with. And it hurt even more when we saw the man with the stash, Gardner Minshew, producer Heather Schatz's favorite player that has ever played for the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yes.
Absolutely just have a beautiful game against the New York Jets. And honestly, was really happy to see it, not only because it's great to see him having some success over there, but also because if he continues to play, remember that trade that the Jags made with the Eagles for Gardner, if he plays in for three games at least 50% of the offensive plays for the team, the Jags' sixth-round pick that they received from the Eagles becomes a fifth-round pick instead. So you kind of hope maybe he plays just a little bit more. Well, that game was on at 1 p.m., and then at 4 o'clock, the Jags took on the L.A. Rams, and man, oh, man, was this not a good game.
Do you just get tired of reporting on this constant parade of laws?
Melissa, I'm not the only one. I've been living in Jacksonville basically my entire life. I've never seen just all the sports reporters just collectively have given up on even really talking about the team. You know, we do it because we, you know, it is our job. It is our job to talk about it, but just so many of us are tired because we just don't see progress. You know, you mm-hmm. want, you see other teams, you see them making progress. The Detroit Lions hadn't even won a single game all year. They won yesterday.
Hey, and the Lions won.
The Jags still lost. And that was one of the frustrating things is, you know, yesterday they had a chance to at least try to keep this game close. It looked like they might do it. It was only 16-7 going into halftime. And then the Rams scored 21 unanswered. And again, one of the biggest things that we saw was James Robinson. He fumbled for the second week in a row. Okay, it happens. You know, some players, you fumble the ball one time. They held him out for 20 straight offensive plays. And during those plays, yes, they did score a touchdown with Carlos Hyde, but after that, they didn't really do anything. And this is a guy who last year he rushed for 1,000 yards, and they're holding him out because he fumbled. And, you know, Urban Meyer after the game said, oh, well, you know, he's still not at 100%. We're trying to be cautious. Caution, you're holding him out for 20 straight plays after he fumbled, and you're saying it's because you're being cautioned. That just for a lot of reporters and a lot of fans, that doesn't add up. That almost feels like you're punishing him because he fumbled. I get it. Back when you're a kid, you do that. You try to teach him, hey, you're not supposed to fumble the ball. But at this point, you're hurting his career if you're holding him out for 20 plays just because he fumbled one time. This is a guy who's had a lot of success holding on to the ball. And yes, he's fumbled twice. He fumbled once last week and he fumbled once this week. But still, that just, it doesn't add up when you hear mm-hmm. that. And still, and the bad part too is Trevor Lawrence looks like he's regressing because he's missing a lot of receivers. The receivers he does have are dropping perfectly placed balls, you know, balls that hit the guy in the chest or they get right on their hands and they just drop it. Meanwhile, you see someone like Cooper Kupp on the LA Rams who goes down and grabs a ball that looks like it's going to hit the ground, pulls it up, and then gets a 15-yard reception out of it. You feel really bad because you know Trevor Lawrence is the star of the future, but if they're not putting the pieces around him, you just see how bad this is turning into. And because of the loss yesterday, they eventually lost 37-7. This is the 10th season in the last 11, with the exception being that beautiful run to the AFC Championship game where they've had at least 10 losses on the year. That's 10 years out of the last 11 that Jags fans have had to endure, knowing by the middle of the year there's no hope anymore.
And, you know, Shad Khan has been the owner this time.
And seeing what Jags fans are saying on Twitter, they want everyone gone. They want Urban Meyer gone. They basically want the entire front office gone. And they want Shad Khan gone. You know, he came in. We all thought this might be a real good change. At first, it seemed like, okay, he looks like he's making steps, especially after that AFC Championship run. But then, you know, everything that's happened with Lot J and the whole debacle behind that has just really soured that relationship. And you have to really wonder just how much longer is that relationship going to last one way or the other. And, you know, mm-hmm. this week they're going to Nashville to take on the Tennessee Titans. And it's another game that even despite the fact the Titans are missing their star running back in Derrick Henry, I just don't see, the only game I see them really being having a chance to win for the rest of the year is the December 19th matchup against the Houston Texans. And that's a team that isn't even doing well at all. And that's the only team I can even see them possibly beating for the rest of the year. Everybody else, I just don't see a path with the way this team is right now to get a win.
Just get us to the end of this season is all I can say. Okay, you also monitored a little bit of college football, college basketball, even some volleyball this weekend.
Yes, we'll start off with some college football. You had the most exciting match of the year, or at least we thought it was going to be. Number one ranked Georgia Bulldog going against number three Alabama Crimson Tide, and this one turned into a dud. The Crimson Tide are inevitable. They came into this game and absolutely demolished the number one defensive team in the country, 41-24 in the SEC championship game. This means Alabama is ranked number one, but do not fret, Bulldog fans. You guys might get another chance at them. In the final rankings for the year, Alabama is number one. Georgia came in number three, which means they are going to play number two, Michigan, in the first round of the college football playoffs in the Orange Bowl in Miami. The winner is going to take on the whoever wins the Alabama-Cincinnati game. Florida head welcomed their new head coach, Billy Napier, to Gainesville yesterday. He actually just got his first, not his first, but he just won his conference championship on Saturday, flew down on Sunday to have his first press conference in Gainesville. And not only that, they received their bowl invitation. They're going to play in the Gasparilla Bowl in Tampa against UCF. So UCF fans, you guys have been begging for Florida for a little bit. Here we go, baby. This is it. We go to the Tax Slayer Bowl right here in Jacksonville. It's going to be Wake Forest against former FSU coach Jimbo Fisher and Texas A&M on New Year's Eve. Game's going to be at 11 a.m. FSU didn't get to go to a bowl game this year, but they did get some good news. Defensive end Jermaine Jones II was named ACC Player of the Year. He had 70 tackles, including 19 for a loss and 12 sacks. We go to college basketball. UNF's men's basketball team, not off to a great start, but they do have played a lot of tough teams. They lost two of their three games this past week. They currently sit at 2-8 on the season. Meanwhile, their crosstown rivals, Jacksonville University, won their only game of the year, a 67-56 win over Charleston Southern. They sit at 4-2 on their year. UNF women's basketball team also had a rough week. They dropped both of their games. They sit at 5-4 on the year. JU's women's team won all three of their games from the week. They sit at 5-3 on the year. We go to a little volleyball. UNF's volleyball team, they're in their first ever postseason tournament in the National Invitational Volleyball Tournament. They just beat Troy last night, three straight sets, and that means they're going on to the quarterfinals to play UConn on Wednesday.
Good luck to them. Okay, let's talk really quickly about your favorite, racing.
Yes, we had the Nitro Rallycross. They raced at the Firm in Stark, Florida for their championship race. The championship was coming down to X Games legend Travis Pastrana and, because I know you know how much I love it, former F1 racer turned rallycross driver Scott Speed. He was the last American to ever race full-time in F1, for those people who would like to know that. But Pastrana won the championship thanks to a daring move down into turn one, and he clinched the championship for 2021.
Would you ever be a racer yourself? Do you dream of that?
I would love to.
You want to do it?
One, I'm way too old to be a professional race driver.
And you're not that old.
And then two, Melissa, it is very expensive to get into racing. I appreciate all the race car drivers out there, but it is a very, very expensive sport to get into.
Someone needs to sponsor Josh Torres so that he can start a new hobby. In the meantime, follow him at Josh is a Polar Bear on Twitter for all of his sports takes. And thank you for directing this show, too.
Thank you, Melissa.
Up next, it's Come From Away, the Broadway musical about the true story of the small town in Newfoundland that welcomed the world after September 11th. We'll speak with the show's star and the Canadian mayor who inspired this amazing story. That's next.
Serve Pro of Jacksonville South, Arlington, Jacksonville East, and Jacksonville West Side, Orange Park. Whether it's water, mold, or fire damage, we'll help you restore your home or business. Serve Pro of Jacksonville South, Arlington, Jacksonville East, and Jacksonville West Side, Orange Park. Available 24/7, 721-2230. Congaree & Penn Landscape Trees. Now specializing in landscape and architectural lighting. More info and appointments available at congaretrees.com or 527-1945.
Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings wrote about Florida in the 1930s and 40s. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Anne McCutcheon, author of The Life She Wished to Live, a biography of Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings. We'll discuss Florida's territorial period and endangered historic places. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
China's newfound prosperity can be seen on the dinner table. Lots more meat. For some people in China, it's meat at every meal. Pork, beef, chicken, and lamb. Meanwhile, Chinese authorities want to reduce greenhouse gases by cutting back on meat consumption. A solution may be found in plant-based meat substitutes, but fake meat might be a hard sell in China. Our story from Shanghai on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Those planning to travel over the holidays have new rules to follow as the world works to contain the Omicron variant. Mask requirements are being extended, and flying into and out of the country has gotten a lot more complicated. What do these new restrictions mean for you and for a travel industry that had hoped the worst was behind us? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. A new musical opens tomorrow night at the Times Union Center. Come From Away is the Tony Award-winning show about the true story of a small town in Newfoundland who welcomed the world after September 11th. For more about Come From Away, I spoke with the former mayor of the town of Gander in Newfoundland, Claude Elliott, and the actor who plays him in this production, Kevin Carolan. Guys, it's so good to be with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, in a moment, Kevin, I want to hear all about the production and your part in the show. But first, let's begin with Mayor Claude. Take us back to September 12th, 2001, and the extraordinary events that happened in your part of the world that inspired this play. What happened on that date?
Well, I guess that day was like any other ordinary day when we started the day, but little did we know that a few hours in the day that it wouldn't be ordinary for the next 4 or 5 days. And, you know, we knew that we had 7,000 people in town that needed help, that was going to be here for a while. And we just mobilized the town and the community and the community surrounding, and we put everything in to make those people comfortable, give them lots of food to eat, give them somewhere to sleep, give them some compassion. And, you know, they needed, I think that most of the pastures needed probably love and compassion as more as they needed food at that time, considering what was happening in the U.S. So it was it was a bit hectic for 5 days, but it was a good hectic. And, you know, we made lifelong friends, and we became like a family.
These are 7,000 people stranded in Newfoundland because of the chaos in the skies after the events of September 11th, and they came from all over, right?
Yeah, we had people from 95 countries here in Gander, but most of the people that we have were U.S. citizens.
Wow. So that brings us to Come From Away. Kevin, you play former Mayor Claude in the show, and the show is told both through story and song. So give us a little window into this production and how we'll be entertained, but we'll also learn about the story.
To have the story evolve from interviews that David Hine and Irene Sankoff had done prior to creating the musical, hours and hours of interviews that they spent on the 10th anniversary, talking to the plain people and talking to the residents of Gander, and to create over the next few years a piece of art that is the story of this incredible event, told through 12 actors and 8 musicians and like a couple of tables and 12 chairs. And we, you know, bring the audience in as best we can through our storytelling, through David and Irene and the songs, and through all of the other wonderful theatrical events that come together to make this a show, our lighting, our set. And we're able to convey this story the extraordinary story, and the fact that it's been playing as long as it has, you know, pandemic accepted, is a testament to it. The story resonates, and it continues to resonate 20 years after the event happened.
Right. I love the tagline, "We can all make the world better with small acts of kindness." And let me ask you too, Kevin, the authentic music of the region is used in Come From Away. Is that right?
That's right. It's kind of a mix. It's got very heavy Irish Celtic influences, and we reflect that in some of the band members that we've got. You know, we've got some pipes playing, and we've got a fiddle and mandolin, a couple of guitars, and all of that really just creates a very welcoming sound for our audience.
So, Mayor Claude, we'll get to see what life is like on Newfoundland without ever going there. I wish I could visit a place like Newfoundland. I guess this is the next best thing.
Well, it certainly is. You know, we have a rich history here in the province of Newfoundland. You know, we're in Holland out in the Atlantic Ocean. Over the years, we've had, you know, some harsh weathers, and the climate here is not always the best. But I say we have the warmest people in the world, and we have a people that is willing to help, whether it's your neighbor, whether it's your family, or if it's complete strangers. It doesn't matter. When people are in need, we'll be there to help them. And September 11, 2001 was no different. You know, it was a bunch of strangers that showed up, but by the time they left, they were like family to us. And like I said before, we've had lifelong friendships with them. And it's just one thing that our world needs today is to hear some good news stories, I can reassure you. And this is a good news story.
Isn't that the truth? So folks, get your tickets now for Come From Away, a limited engagement at the Times Union Center for the Performing Arts, December 7th through 12th. Tickets at fscjartistseries.org. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Have fun at that show, and thanks for listening to this show. And thanks to Heather Schatz, Josh Torres, Catherine Hobbs, Jessica Palumbo, Randy Roguski, and our entire WJCT News team. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Monday, everyone. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.